In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Welcome, everyone, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. Today, we're going to be talking about the games we played this week, but first, we're going to talk about the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago, and lastly, we will talk about...
No! The order is all wrong, no. Walker! No, stop! You're hurting me!
First, we're going to talk about the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago, then the games we played this week, and then our topic of the week...
No! You might... Oh, for two, all Walker. Right, this right. is ridiculous.
I'll be good.
Yes, Walker. Try to pretend like you're.
I was going to throw the news at the end.
Before
the topic.
No,
you're no fun.
Jeez, I'm the editor. That's why I'm no fun.
All right. First, we're going to talk about the games. First, we're going to talk about the game we reviewed.
You can't turn it off. That's the problem. You get so down to the. This is what happens, Walker. You start out as a troll. You start out trolling, and then suddenly you're so far deep you don't remember who you are anymore.
In the troll hole. All right, first we're going to talk about the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Then the games we played this week, some news and why it doesn't matter. Then we're going to do the topic of the week, which is what makes long games worth it.
Before we get into that, though, a minor correction from last week. I'd like to sincerely apologize for the omission. We have a policy here at So Very Wrong About Games. When we talk about a game that is a review copy that has been sent to us either by the publisher or by the designer or even by a distributor, we'd like to disclose this. But during our discussion last week of... Hot Streak, we neglected to mention that this was a review copy we got from the publisher. Mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. We think the disclosure is very important, and we apologize for this. If you're at all curious about our policy with respect to review copies, you can find more information on our website, where we have a variety of policies that we've articulated there, as well as regular digressions on one of the Patreon bonus shows like Bloat.
Also, if you're watching the live game that we played of Hot Streak, I know we talked about it in the review that you burned three cards off the top, but while we were playing, we neglected to burn the top three cards off of the deck before we started moving the racers. Just so you know, that is part of the rules as well.
So let's move on to the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Eurus. 1 year ago, we reviewed the game Gnar by Thomas Dupont, published by Bombix in 2023, and we've been playing it pretty consistently ever since.
We have. It is like one of those games like I talked about, which is like, well, Mark didn't agree, but I think it's like Hot Streak, which is a very rich experience, all contained in a small box that is very quick to set up, very quick to teach.
Okay, expressed thus, yes, they are similar, but I don't think they're similar kinds of games past that.
No, I just meant like sort of that one gem of the year that just has the whole package. Components, easy to teach. We had Gnar, we had Sky Team, we've got Harmonies, and we have Hot Streak. Anyway, Gnar, fantastic game. The art is so good. The gameplay, interesting and engaging. Still love Gnar.
Yep, Gnar is great. There's a reason why it's kept coming back to the table. And it's easy to go back to after a few months' absence. It's a great way to open the night. It's a great way to close the night. It is a very, very flexible, filler-length, satisfying game with quality decision-making nonetheless. And you've been hearing us talk about it regularly. That's Gnar by Thomas Dupont. So, Walker, what are the games you played last week?
Mark, we got to play Autobahn. I'm not going to talk about it too much because I think it's going to come up in our topic an awful lot. I think that's the reason why this topic was picked.
It was certainly part of the inspiration, yes.
So Autobahn is designed by Fabio Lupiano and Nestore Magione and put out by Alley Cat Games. It is a game that takes place in it's sort of the building of the German Autobahn. You're putting in fueling stations and shipping, and you're building highways, and it, you know, goes over certain points of the Great Wall falling and stuff like that. It's very interesting.
The Great Wall? We built the Autobahn straight to China.
Sorry, not the Great Wall.
The Great Wall couldn't stop the Mongols, but can't stop the Autobahn.
Anyway, it covers the fall.
In China being like, what the hell is going on? Why is a BMW? Oh my goodness, what are they doing? Straight through the wall.
It covers the fall of the wall.
Yes, the Berlin Wall.
The Berlin Wall.
Yeah, the Iron Curtain. Yeah, because during eras 1 and 2, which roughly bring you from the 1960s-ish up until the 1980s, you are dealing exclusively in West Germany. And then when Era 3 begins, and we're talking about the 80s at that point, the Berlin Wall falls, and you can then expand into East Germany, it leads to a new land rush. Because in Era 2, especially, things start to get a little dense, and you start to worrying about eking out those marginal extra points, and you start to look to new horizons, which are only available once the wall falls. And so it leads to a very interesting sort of dynamic from that perspective. If it can be historically inflected, all the better. And so Audubon being historically inflected in that way is both structurally excellent as well as thematically reinforcing. And so I'm a huge fan of the way that sets up.
Yeah, and all the highways are color-coded, and that leads to the core of the game. You have this hand of cards, and anything you do is color-coded. So if I want to play this orange card, well, it can only take place on the orange highway, be it build the highway, upgrade the highway, build a rest stop there, anything like that. It's a great sort of way to drive the game.
Ever since the release of Kalamala, Fabio Lopiano has been on our radar, because Kalamala was designed by Fabio Lopiano and is a thoroughly excellent middleweight Euro game. And he's done some heavier stuff, usually as a co-design, and he's done work with Nestore Mangione and other Italian designers in the past. But I don't think any of his heavy designs have approached the quality of Kalamala until Audubon. Audubon, I think, is absolutely the very best of his heavier Euros. It has an interesting action selection mechanism, interesting dynamics between the players, a very focused scoring system, which I want all heavier Euros to have. You can just gesture to one part of the board and be like, this is how you score. And it doesn't spiral off into a whole bunch of weird combinatorics, which I'm willing to tolerate in some contexts, but is not my preferred setup for heavier Euros. Audubon's a real winner. And despite the fact that it is longer, I do absolutely find it worth it. The time flies by because of how engaged I am. I love Audubon. That's Audubon.
That's Audubon.
I got to play Scythe. I was able to bring Scythe back to the table after a long delay. We're huge fans of Scythe. A lot of people have soured on it. I can understand why. If you play canned openings, if you're the kind of player who's either played a game enough, is inclined to figure these things out on your own, or is inclined to consult strategy guides, I could completely understand why Scythe would become mechanical and uninteresting. I don't think many games can survive contact with canned openings. And indeed, it kind of changes the experience away to something else that I don't enjoy. It's, you know, it's one of those things where you look at people who play chess a lot, and what they're doing is, yeah, they're kind of playing a board game, but that's not playing a board game the way I play board games. It's a radically different kind of activity. Not to say that it's better or worse, it's just different. My version of the hobby doesn't involve things like study or memorization. That's just not why I get into hobby games. And so Scythe played more intuitively, more experientially, more even experimentally in some cases, is very much the kind of Euro game that I'm interested in doing. And so I was very, very pleased to play it again. I do like how there's kind of, I'm tempted to say, like, inflection points or set pieces that are involved in Scythe. Not, again, that can lead to the desire to make canned openings or memorizing particular gambits, but it doesn't have to. One of them being how you're going to get out of your initial little corner of the map, because most factions start behind water, and crossing that water barrier, there are a number of different ways to do it. All of them are expensive, and so you have to kind of figure out how and when you want to do that. There's the push to the factory to get a new action card, which are really, really cool. There's the desire to spread out to capture more of those encounter tokens and how hard you want to push for that. Anyway, all of these trade-offs that I very much love about Scythe were absolutely present. We played with four players. The game sped along at a very, very good clip. It's got a very good internalized sense of flow that is written into the rulebook, where they say, look, you might be doing a top half action and you might be doing a bottom half action. The bottom half action doesn't have anything to do with player interaction, really. So the moment you're done your top half, tell the next player to start going. And that, I think, really it was an excellent suggestion. It's my favorite of the Stonemaier games. We like Scythe. People give us crap for it, but whatever.
Whatever. Next time we play it, I really want to do the modular map.
Yeah.
Because I've yet to try that.
The modular map came out. We both got the modular map. And then we stopped playing Scythe. It was like the opposite of, oh, there's a new expansion coming. We can't play the game. This was, oh, we bought the expansion. Now we don't play the game anymore. Which is unfortunate. And having gotten Scythe back into rotation, hopefully, This will provide us an opportunity to do so. Unfortunately, Dewey really hates Scythe. Scythe is a little divisive in our group, but I think that we'll have an opportunity before too long to try out the modular board. So that's Scythe by Jamie Stegmaier, published by Stonemaier Games in 2016. This is the pre-Wingspan days, Walker.
Ooh.
Yeah.
We've got Fairy Tale to the table. This is designed by Sadochi Nakamura, and the edition we played was the
2008 What's Your Game edition.
Yes. And so there's lots of editions, so many editions with different symbology and different little modular additions that you can add on to the game.
Yep.
I prefer the one that I have. Mark prefers the one that he has. Everyone prefers their own edition.
Sure.
Long story short.
Sure.
Oh, no. I'm willing to agree that the symbology on the What's Your Game edition is confusing and sort of plays loosey-goosey with colors and symbols.
Sometimes the color refers to... They chose these colors for flip or unflip. The original English edition was published in 2004 by Z-Man Games. And there's this idea of having cards be flipped face down, so they're effectively, they don't score and they don't have their effect, and then unflipping them, which then brings them face up and brings them back into play effectively. And that's all well and good. And you do, admittedly, when you use the terms flip and unflip, have to explain to people that you cannot flip a flipped card. Flip exclusively means two face down, sure. Other editions, like the What's Your Game edition, use the verbs close and open, which I think is an improvement, frankly. However, in the iconography on the card, they have a sort of flip arrow, and they use red for close or flip, or green for open or unflip. And the problem is that red and green are also suits, and the cards that flip an unflip card are also suit dependent. And so some of them will only unflip a red card. So it's like, oh, well, this card says flip a red card, but it doesn't mean a red card. It means flip in the red way to a green card. Can you follow me yet? And so a number of people, when I saw it, I was a little aghast. I had forgotten about how misleading they could potentially be. I'm also not a huge fan of the arrows for you versus everyone. It's a little too subtle. I mean, granted, the Z-Man edition is language dependent. That is absolutely a burden. But the edition that I prefer is the 2014 Z-Man 2nd edition. The expansion cards are potentially of dubious value, but you can leave them out if you want to. And I do prefer the iconography, and it gives you more coverage of the artwork. I'm sorry, I have one more complaint about the What's Your Game edition. You have to admit that this is a bit obnoxious. The most prominent number associated with a variety of cards is just a random card number. It's not the number of times it's in the deck, nor is it the score value. It's just this number. It's like, oh, well, that's because it's card number 6. Is it worth 6 points? No. Are there 6 in the deck? No. It's card number 6. How is this helpful? Anyway.
It is not. So what Fairy Tale is a drafting game. Everyone's given a bunch of cards. You draft one until you have 5, and then you're only going to play 3 of them. So you can sort of hedge your bets. It's like, I really want to play these particular 3, but if someone makes me turn down certain cards, then I have these backup cards. You do this 4 times.
And it's an excellent, excellent throttle for hate drafting. It means that you're more, like so many drafting games I play, even ones I like It's a Wonderful World, I almost never hate draft because it's like, okay, well, this is the one that's best for me, so I'll take this one. But if you're only going to be playing 3 and you look at this card, it's like, oh, that card would be okay for me. Oh, but Walker really needs it. Oof, I'd better draft it.
Yeah, because you don't have to play it. It just goes into the discard. My card goes into the discard. The one that I wanted, the one that I was going to have fun playing.
Yeah, the thing you needed goes into the discard just like your hopes and dreams. Yeah.
So you do this 4 times and then it has this... I don't want to say elaborate, some semi-elaborate when you base it off of other games. It's like you need 2 of these cards. If you don't have this card, then this doesn't score. And then the more you have of this card will score more points, but you have to have at least 1 of these cards, this type of thing. And you get a point value, and that's Fairy Tale. It is excellent.
I will absolutely grant that the scoring is the most complicated part of the game. This is because there's practically nothing else to the game. in a good way. Because you just draft the cards. The card effects, most people get a little confused because it's one of those games where you're not really playing the card for its effect most of the time. Some cards have effects, but that's usually secondary. Fairy Tale is much more akin to Fantasy Realms in that it is a very, very straightforward, just get the cards together to combo off each other to score higher points. The difference is, and one of the main reasons why I so much prefer Fairy Tale, is that the cards are a little more transparent, even in early plays, and the player interaction from the drafting is shockingly deep.
This being said, it's only like your first game of Fairy Tale, of a session, that is confusing.
Yes.
If you were to immediately play a second game, then it's a cakewalk, everything makes sense and you're off to the races. And then it's going to be back to being, you know, complicated next time you pull the game out. But
well, maybe it depends on
how frequently. Yes.
And keep in mind, this is a game that was originally published in English in 2004, and it's very much of its era in that it is much, much simpler than a lot of other games contemporarily. And so when we say that the scoring can be a little bit burdensome, this you have to keep in mind this is on a very, very heavy curve.
So that is Fairy Tale.
Fairy Tale remains my favorite drafting game. Really? As far as pure drafting goes, I still think it's the one to beat.
I like to go right into Moon after that, only because it is very similar in the fact that you are drafting a card. Everyone's drafting cards and playing it. This is the game that I stream this week, so if you're interested, you can always go to our live channel on YouTube and check it out. This is designed by Hacken Gardner and put out by Sinister Fish Games.
I don't trust that fish.
And it's a little bit like Ryan Lockhart in the fact that Hacken Gardner, he not only designs the games for them, but he also illustrates all of them. There's also Streets and Villagers. I did play Streets, didn't enjoy it very much. Apparently the version on Board Game Arena is a little bit better because it takes care of all the fiddly bits for you.
Sure.
Because you're constantly moving the villagers from different cards to other cards depending on what's being played, and sometimes you might forget, but apparently Board Game Arena takes care of all of that, so that might be interesting to try out. But anyway, let's talk about Moon. You are sort of building your sort of moon base up, and you need flags and sort of that sort of like reputation. Because the more reputation you have in a certain flag, the more opportunities you have to score. And you always start with one, and you try to build more because certain cards you need, certain factions to play it, and resources. So you're trying to get resources and flags. But the problem, it just seemed as though it just didn't. There was nothing fun to do in the game, unlike other games like Fairy Tales, where you're getting like interesting combos in Fairy Tale, or you really need a certain card, or it's like all the cool. You know, there's this one card that scores an amazing amount of points, but you need this one elf queen. If you don't get the single elf queen, then it's worth nothing. So it's that, you know, that hoping that you're going to get that one card. But anyway, in Moon, it's just like, oh, this one will give me four symbols instead of that. And then you have these rovers that are going to get you. I sort of enjoyed the puzzly bit of it. It's one of those things, when it's your turn, I really want to play this card. What weird things can I do? It's just the fact that there's no way that a card is going to come back to you. Unlike Fairy Tale, where you can sort of look at the board, and you can say, well, they're not collecting elves. They could hate draft it. But barring that, it's probably going to come back. In the Moon, all the cards are sort of mediocrely equally good. So they could play that one or not play that. There's no reason. There's no here or there why they wouldn't. They could be, well, he already has, you know, eight purple flags. So maybe he won't play the purple flags, or he'll just take it and, you know, to secure his purple flags. It's just like, it's one of these things where there's no way to know. And in the end, I just don't think I'll go back to Moon.
I have to say, having played Villagers, I definitely got the vibe of generic. Other than the visuals, I liked the visuals. It was very, very neat and minimalist in sort of a color blocking way. But it definitely felt like a very generic drafting tableau builder. And drafting tableau builder is kind of sort of a one of the many flavors of default generic Euro that I've played a million times before. And unless you give me a reason to prefer this one, I'm just going to end up forgetting about it and going back to the drafting Euro builders I like.
Yeah, plus the time it takes. Man, it was very long.
Oh, really?
For what you did.
Huh.
Yeah.
How long are we talking?
I'd have to go back and look. At least more than an hour.
Hmm. Got to play Spots. Spots is by Alex Haig, John Perry, and Justin Vickers, published by CMYK. Being reminded, of course, of the excellence of John Perry and CMYK more generally from the Most Excellent Hot Streak, was very keen to play Spots again. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. Spots is a push-your-luck dice game, and I have to say, and keep in mind the scale at which I'm saying here, it's probably my least favorite John Perry design. It's still very good. I still enjoy it a great deal. The art is delightful. You are using dice to fill in spots of Dalmatians and maybe some sneaky non-Dalmatians that are also spotted animals that are pretending to be dogs. Anyway, and the thrust of it is that if you roll dice and you can't place them on the cards you have, they end up building up in your yard. And if your yard gets too high, everything wipes off your display. And so you're constantly balancing whether it is the case that you can roll more dice, whether you've got a good spread, whether you have to take your time, whether you have to bank what you've already scored. There are a number of interesting trade-offs involved when playing Spots. There's also a huge variety of different actions you can take. At the end of the day, it's all about rolling dice and filling in dogs, but there are also actions you can get to get rerolls, to deal with the dice you weren't able to play, to reroll dice that you've already placed, etc., etc. And there's a big stack of various actions, and you choose four of them. They get added to two actions you use every game, and that can lead to a certain degree of variety in terms of how you're doing it. I just really like managing the tempo, how many dogs you have active at a given time, when to score. That's the big decision. In a lot of push-your-luck games, it's all about managing the tempo after all, because in theory, you can win a game of Can't Stop on your second turn, in theory. But in practice, that's not usually going to be the way that it is. So it's about deciding when and where to make your stands. And sure enough, Spots is the same. I prefer Spots to Can't Stop for what it's worth. But then again, Can't Stop is not exactly one of my preferred push-your-luck games. As I've said before, what I like about push-your-luck games is where you're confronted with different challenges at different elements of your playtime, based on where you happen to be in your own personal game or even in the table state. So, for example, when you're playing Can't Stop, every throw of the dice is essentially the same as the one before once you've committed your flags for the given turn. But in the context of something like Spots, or in the case of Raw, it really matters how many dice do I have active? How many dogs do I have active? How many tiles of a certain type do I have in the case of Raw? Can I risk there being some other tiles being added here, etc., etc.? So timing, I think, to me, makes the difference between an acceptable push-your-luck game and a push-your-luck game that I really want to get behind. It's the texture that I really appreciate. And so I thoroughly enjoy Spots. I think it's a great little filler. I think it is charming and delightful the way almost all CMYK designs are. And John Perry, I think, remains the king of small box games, and he co-designed this with Alex Haig and Justin Vickers. That's Spots 2022.
So Warm Boy picked up a copy of Ito, or I-T-O?
I think it's Ito, because Ito? I think it's Japanese in origin.
This is published by Arclight Games, and they have several different editions, as Mark informed me today. This is another game we stream, so if you're interested, check out the live channel. And it's very similar to Figment, which is the CMYK sort of how much color is on this particular card, where there's this hypothetical question, and you make up your answer based on the number you have, and then you're trying to slot it in this, you know, line of 1 through 100, and you're trying to gauge what people think. So a question like, most popular movie star, and you'll make up a name, like you'll say Jim Carrey, and you'll look at your number and say, well, Jim Carrey's kind of pop. I have a 64 market.
64. I don't think so.
I really like Jim Carrey.
Yeah, okay.
And he's made a lot of movies.
Okay.
I think he's a 64. So okay. I'm going to say Jim Carrey, and I'll put up my 64. Okay. No one else knows it's a 64. I know it's 64.
You're trying to communicate your 64-ness to the rest of the table by picking Jim Carrey.
I'll put
Carrey
my color on it just to remind me that that's my card. And so when people ask what that is, I can tell them that's Jim Carrey. And everyone will come up with a movie star, and they'll slot it where they think. And then once everyone's decided on their card, then you'll have the discussion on whether things should move or not. And it's subjective, of course, right? Well, one person might like a particular actor more than another, and you sort of have to take that into consideration.
How popular?
It's like, I've heard Mark talk about that actor a lot, so he really likes it, even though, you know, in general, he's not that good.
How popular is Nick Cage, Walker?
Exactly. Well, apparently, to some, not very popular at all.
Well, a lot of the categories are phrased in terms of popularity,
yeah,
right?
It's a rough word.
It is a rough word because, and I think this leads to a substantial problem with respect to Ito, because people will make a good faith effort to respond to the terms as presented in a game. If you're trying to gauge popularity, that's like an extra level of subjectivity. If it were something like your favorite actor, well, that's simple. How much does Walker like Jim Carrey? But if the question is popular actor, then I have to ask, how popular does Walker think John Carrey?
or what do I think popular is, first of all?
Yeah. What is Walker's apprehension of other people's apprehension in the zeitgeist of... Anyway, so it becomes a whole thing. And so on top of that, and this is, I think, my biggest issue with Ito, I'm not a huge fan, you can't have the interesting discussion while playing the game. Because Walker puts out Jim Carrey, and then we're not even having a discussion about Jim Carrey. We're having a discussion about Walker's fifis about Jim Carrey, first of all. But even setting that aside, we can't have the discussion with Walker about things. Now, very often in a lot of other games, you can't have the discussion while you're playing either, but there's an immediacy to it. So, for example, Green Team Wins, right? You're playing Green Team Wins, and we're talking about, you know, most popular actor or this or that or whatever. And Walker puts out his Jim Carrey or whatever, and that's either a strikingly uncommon answer or a very, very surprising one. We get to immediately talk about Walker's views on Jim Carrey.
The only one when everyone flips it over. Yeah. I had a great analogy with Green Team Wins.
Okay.
All right. Green Team Wins is you have your container of jam. And you put the whole thing on a corner of bread. And you take your bite. Best bite ever. But then you have the rest of this piece of toast now with no jam on it.
And what does that represent?
Well, it just represents, you know, that the fact that they're scoring and the wait time. And just I'm
the
not
wait
saying it's
time.
Terrible. I'm not saying...
And Green Team Wins?
Well, I'm just saying... There's the other things. Like the meat of the jam is...
The meat of the jam now...
Is when you flip over... Is when everyone flips over their answer and you have that reveal moment.
Right.
And you have the talk.
Okay.
Whereas I feel with ITO is you've spread the jam over the whole bread.
Oh, I disagree.
I think it's the same amount of jam, but it's a lot thinner. And
the bread's much bigger.
And the bread's much bigger.
So first of all, I disagree about how Green Team Wins has some sort of... You're implying that there is a suboptimal or undesirable ratio of good stuff to not good stuff in Green Team Wins. I thoroughly disagree. I don't find the scoring or the period of waiting people to write down their answer to be particularly burdensome. It's simultaneous play, and the scoring is straightforward. You score the one, you tick off a box, or you don't tick off a box.
The fact that there's score at all is what I meant.
That there's a score at all. Okay, fine. That's a preference thing. I'm willing to cede that. Ito, it's just weird because you're having this very circuitous discussion in which the actual interesting bits, specifically Walker's relationship to the Zeitgeist's relationship to Jim Carrey, insofar as that is an interesting discussion to be had, is utterly empty because Walker can't participate in the discussion. I'm not feeling it, I gotta say. On top of that, I will say the following, though. There are effectively now three ways to play Ito. The way it was originally published, the way that it's been published in this English edition on the Arclight Games version. Those two have differences, but I don't find the differences particularly interesting. Whatever, I'd happily play either way. And then there's the Red String of Destiny version, which, if you're all familiar with the Asian myth about the Red String of Destiny, it turns Ito into a dating game, which absolutely makes me more happier. Instead of cooperatively trying to arrange the numbers in order, what you're trying to do is find a mate at the table whose number, when added to yours, will get you as close to possible as to 100. And so you're there sitting there with your 65 or whatever, and you're trying to say Jim Carrey because you're trying to communicate to somebody with a card of roughly value 35 to come on over and partner up with you. And the partnering happens in real time. And so I don't know if this would result in a certain amount of negotiation or a certain amount of cajoling or whatever. That part, whatever. I just find this that is a potentially interesting spin on this formula of Ito. If you're inclined to play Ito again, which I suspect you are, I would ask that we try that version.
Sure.
Because the base version, I've now played 5 or 6 times. It's really not doing it for me, especially when compared to the other sort of... I'd rather play Fun Facts than Ito, and I don't like Fun Facts very much, frankly.
They are very similar. Same problem.
Yeah, similar issues, similar dynamic. I'd say they're much... Ito is much more similar to Fun Facts than it is to Figment. So that's Ito, designed by 326... And this edition was published by Arclight Games in 2019. Played a game of Deep Rock Galactic. This is the adaptation of the video game designed by Ole Steinis, published by Mood Publishing in 2022. We did a full review a few months ago, and very much consistent with my experience. It's fine. It's pretty good. It's enjoyable. I'm more than willing to move things around and toss dice. It gets a number of things pretty darn right, like how the enemy activation is reasonably straightforward. A number of things are rendered particularly burdensome by the fact that the rulebook organization and cross-referencing is pretty bad, even by the standards of, broadly speaking, dungeon crawl games, which, as a rule, don't tend to cover themselves in glory on that particular topic. We have an edition with just only the player characters. The dwarves are represented by miniatures. The rest are standees. And frankly, that's fine. That's honestly the way I'd be happy to do things. You can get the fully kitted out version where everything is a miniature, but I don't think that would be particularly necessary.
It'd be very gray.
It would be very gray. It would be much more difficult to store, and the burden economically would be considerable. So there's been this broader push in games of this ilk to try to find a way to minimize the plastic footprint. And frankly, I think that's the way to do it. If you can do it in a reasonably straight, like this started with Gloomhaven. Gloomhaven was one of the first games to really do this in a substantial way. But then, of course, a few years later, yeah. Gloomhaven offered
a full miniature pack. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a whole thing. Anyway, I do still wish that Deep Rock Galactic leaned into a little bit more of the interesting bit, which is the mining element. We did a lot more of it this session than we did in past sessions. Like, you can spend actions to basically terraform the map, to make new openings in the map where there weren't before. It's not trivial, and it's occasionally fraught, but it can be worth it, especially when the alternative is going with where there's a huge number of enemies and or chasms, and so it's too dangerous and time-consuming. Walker, in particular, in a particular Gonzo move, the map was more or less a donut, and he's like, well, rather than going around the circumference, what if I just went straight through? And he did. And yeah. It was glorious. Yeah. So those moments, I think, are definitely where Deep Rock Galactic is at its best, because the rest of it is fine, the rest of it's functional. But if you're going to lean into the theme, I've never played the video game for what it's worth, but a broad mining theme, and lean into how this is differentiated from the hordes of other, I get the dice together to throw the dice to kill things, I am perfectly willing to do that. I still find that enjoyable after decades in the hobby, but if you're able to do something different, you might as well do something different.
Yeah, I like the fact that the monsters are adequately different. You know, they all do their own sort of thing. Even the player characters, you know, although very similar, still have their own sort of thing that they get to do that makes them different than everybody else. And, you know, gives you a mission, sort of like, oh, I'm going to be the guy that helps people get across these chasms. I'm going to be the guy that's really good at mining. Stuff like that. You get to upgrade. When you have a game that lets you upgrade things, people are going to enjoy it. It's the,
really?
It's the Pokemon factor, Mark. It's
Pokemon
just,
factor.
Yeah, because you know your Pokemon, you upgrade your Pokemon. They get better and better.
You mean evolving them, or are you just talking about basically leveling up?
Yeah, leveling up.
Yeah, most dungeon crawls let you do that. I mean, okay.
Yeah, but it's after sessions sometimes. Usually, so this not, one is in the middle of the game. You get to upgrade your weapons and stuff.
I don't know what you're talking about, man. A lot of games. Okay, sure.
There are a lot that you upgrade during the game. And there are a lot that you only upgrade after the session.
Fair enough, Walker. That's Deep Rock Galactic by Ole Steinus, published by Mood Publishing 2022.
We also quickly played Flip 7. Flip 7 is Flip 7. It is fast, it is funny, there are stories, there is laughter.
There are stories?
There is injustice. Well, there was. We were talking, we had paperwork. We had asterisks.
Yeah, the paperwork.
There's things happening. That's
things happen. Yes, things happened over the course.
I'm saying
there was.
That's a thing. It wasn't nothing, Mark.
The paperwork, the funny notes in the paperwork were merely notes about how our dear friend Dewey, who is accustomed to Robert's rules, having been responsible for many, many union meetings, was willing to make a note to reflect the fact that certain participants felt they had been robbed or that there had been injustice done. This is not, I think, a unique feature of the game itself. This is us trying to make do. It's somewhere between our coping with the inherent randomness of the game and what you said of being a story. It's just the fact that we were laughing at weird random stuff happening.
It was something. It's better than complaining about random weird stuff happening.
Sure, but I will point out that there are other push-your-luck games where you don't have to engage in paperwork at all. Now, I'm not willing to give Flip 7 a pass because by virtue of it forcing us to engage in paperwork, it allowed someone to engage in paper-related jokes. I don't think that's to its credit. In point of fact, I think the fact that you have to engage in scorekeeping in Flip 7 with paper and pen is a detriment.
I suppose.
Yeah. I'd still rather play Roll of Six and win a cookie, because at the end I get a cookie.
Anyway, lots of fun stuff. I enjoy Flip 7. It has some interesting, like, sort of action cards. That,
interesting.
Yeah. Like, look, Flip 3, the freeze, the extra, the times 2. You got that a lot. Man, you must be super special.
Let me tell you a little story. I'm trying to be a more charitable individual with respect to my friends, all right? And when you said, oh, we played Flip 7, I'm like, all right, Mark, dial it back. And you keep using words like, there were stories and the action cards are interesting. It's like, I cannot let that stand this podcast.
In the context of what the game offers, like in this game where you're just simply flipping random cards off the top of the deck.
There you go. That's the game.
Yeah.
Okay.
I never said it was anything more
No,
than that.
I know. Well, let's set aside the storytelling aspect. The action cards are not interesting. They're just more random stuff that benefits some people and hurt others. That doesn't make them interesting.
Well, the fact that it doesn't really take away from the flow of the game and that they do something, the fact that you can play them on other players. Anyway, I find them less egregious than in other games that, you know, say, oh, here's a random card that makes someone lose a turn, right? Anyway.
There's a random card that freezes someone out of the round. There's a random card you can play on somebody that causes them to bust. There's a random card that you can, that means that you don't have to bust.
But they're not always going to bust. It could help them.
Oh, boy. Flip seven.
Hey, it's winning awards out there, Mark.
Apparently it's the greatest card game ever made.
It says so right on the box.
It says so right on the box. I don't hate it.
Race to 200.
I don't hate Flip Seven. I just think it is the it's another like slot machine game. It's honestly in the same category to me as Sausage Sizzle. But you're with me on Sausage Sizzle. You're not with me on Flip Seven. Flip Seven, you want to say, has interesting mechanisms and has interesting cards.
I didn't say extra mechanisms.
You were close.
I said in the context of the game.
Oh, by the bottom basement standards of Flip Seven, these cards are more interesting than merely the card that says seven.
Exactly.
Or four. Sure, I'll grant that.
And that is Flip 7.
Those are the games we played this week. Now a brief break to pay some bills.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
And we're back. And now onto the news and why it doesn't matter. So, Walker, Revive, one of my favorite Euros of the past few years. It is going to get a pseudo-sequel called Recall. Why don't you tell us about it?
Oh, do tell. Yes, from the exact same design team, which is...
That is not true.
I had them side by side. They were the same people.
They're not the same people.
Was there one different?
There's one different. So, Revive was designed by Helge Meissner, Christian Emerson, Osvi, Eilif Svensson, and Anna Wermland. Recall swaps out Eilif Svensson for Kjetil Svensson.
Oh, well, yes.
They're different people.
They're holding them back.
I don't know.
Thank God.
I don't know. Well, also, like, rather than
Revive was going to be great. It is great, but it was those few things
I have zero,
that person added.
You say this, Walker, as a joke. I have zero information. I have zero insider information about this, and I've seen no mention of this anywhere else. But Revive was published by Aporta Games, which is indeed the company founded by Christian Emerson Ostvi and Eilif Svensson. But Recall is going to be published by Alien by Dr. O, which was founded by Christian Emerson Ostvi and Kjetil Svensson.
Well, maybe it was like a big falling out. Maybe it's like big drama.
I don't know. I'm just, I, look,
juicy.
No, stop, no, see, you're one step away from consciously starting a rumor. You know how the internet works. This isn't even speculation, this is merely pointing it out. So yes, Recall is kind of, you know, it's one of those things where it's being positioned, not quite as a pseudo-sequel, but basically like from many of the same people that brought you in kind of sort of the same vein as.
Yeah, the sister game. Right,
more or less, sister, cousin, some kind of a degree of relation. I am very, very much looking forward to it. Apparently, North American distribution is, shall we say, fraught. I don't know why. It's not like there's any
difficulty along with Shackleton base, I'm sure.
Importing things. I don't know. Anyway, so I'm going to try to see if I can get a copy from Europe, see if our local online store is going to be bringing any of them back from Essen, because I am very much looking forward to Recall, because Revive is amazing. I've loved all the work of these designers in the past that I've tried, and they do some interesting stuff. And they're definitely, when it comes to sort of medium-heavy Euros, it's the vibe that I enjoy. And so this is absolutely the kind of thing I look forward to. That is Recall. Once again, Congress, so very wrong about games, fun times, good vibes only, trans rights, a human rights, board game jamboree. It's going to be in Kingston, Ontario, July 25th, 26th, and 27th. Open registration is available on Eventbrite. There is a link in the episode notes. We would love to have you there if you can make it. If the registration fee is in any way a barrier to your attending, let me know, and we will work out a de minimis registration for you. We would love to see you. Looking forward to it. SwagCon. So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. We now move on to our topic. what makes longer games worth it? Because one of the frequent complaints we have here on Sober Wrong About Games, we've been talking about it for years, is, yeah, it's fine, but it's too long. A game can be too long when it's 45 minutes. A game can be too long when it's 70. There's no length at which a game is necessarily too long, but I think we can agree that there's a kind of threshold past which you really better be bringing your A game if you want us to be able to recommend certainly going back to it. For me, that's roughly 2 hours. If it's longer than 2 hours, you would better be doing something. Is that roughly in accordance with your
experience?
Yeah,
no, I'm saying too that the whole thing of what makes constitutes a long game is also up for, yeah.
Obviously, it's situationally dependent.
Because I was like, watching this, some of these people, like the time it takes them to play games, I don't know what's going on. Like, oh,
right.
We played a 12-hour game of TI4, and it's like, what are you doing?
Look, different groups are going to go at their own
pace.
Yeah,
that's what I mean, yeah.
It is impossible, in my experience, to get someone to play faster. It is always possible to get someone to play slower. That you can do. If nothing else, just tackle them on the ground and start choking them. That tends to delay their turns a little bit. But I know of no way to accelerate people's play other than through introducing a timer, which necessarily introduces a certain degree of stress. And so, yeah, some people... I was shocked when we very nearly finished that game of Megasiv in 8 hours. That was much faster, just situationally, than other times. And a lot of people were playing at a relatively stately pace. It's going to take as long as it's going to take. But broadly speaking, 2-ish hours is kind of the threshold at which I start thinking a game is pretty long. And I think we can mention right in the offset the perennial observation that in the right company, any activity yes. is pleasurable, right? And that is one of the virtues of knowing that you're going to be blocking off a significant period of time and all that you're going to be doing is this one thing. It's like, okay, well, this will be an opportunity for it to breathe. We know what the agenda is. And that kind of releases any tension of deciding what to do or thinking we have to get done at a certain rate. And that I find is often a way to best appreciate the company of the people you're playing games with. That's one of the reasons why, when it is my birthday, my preferred birthday activity is to try to get as many people together whose company I enjoy to play Megasiv.
That's why people don't lose heart. You know, even though after 40 years of me playing games, I still yet to find a group that I have fun with, I know over the horizon it will happen soon. I know it.
Do you know why it's funny? It's because we all hate you too.
So I just have a bunch of random sentences here, Mark. That makes
random sentences. That makes, oh no!
That makes what makes long games.
I guess random
worth it?
Random sentences. I think would be better than a series of random words. But okay, hit me with a random sentence, Walker.
So multi-phase games, like we've already talked about this in two games that we talked about, like things like Autobahn, where you're going from, you know, where you open up the east end of Germany,
mm-hmm.
or Scythe, like you said, you're trying to get off of your particular area, like you're broken by water, or in Brass, where it switches from rivers to rails, or Blue Lagoon, where it's just straight up two phases. Like something like that.
To throw together, not a criticism, games of wildly different length.
Yes, different length, but might be long to some people.
Sure.
So the multi-phase things sort of softens the blow of extra long games, I guess you could say.
Absolutely. The way that I always put it, and this is a term I've used many, many times on this podcast, is if a game is going to be long, I want it to have an arc. I want it to be the case that I'm not going to be doing more or less the same thing in the same context every turn. I mean, obviously, even a game that's, say, 20 minutes long can be vastly too repetitive, right? But what I'm talking about is I want the game state to evolve, or at least my play state to evolve and change and ebb and flow. A couple of examples I've got of games that do this very, very well, which are longer, is the aforementioned Civilization. The pressures in the early game are very different from the pressures of the mid game, which are very different from the pressures on the turns when you're recovering from a catastrophe, which are very different from the pressures of the turns where you're pushing for that next AST upgrade. So you're constantly being pulled in different directions, sure, by the fundamental quality of the game mechanisms, but it's also the case that the game has an ebb and flow to it that you feel like you don't feel like you're constantly doing the same thing over and over. Similarly, Successors, which is my favorite multiplayer conflict game, my favorite historical con sim, it has a sense of arc as well because different heirs to Alexander the Great enter the game at different times, as well as there's the issue of the funeral cart being introduced at a certain point of the game. And then there's also this fundamental genius, I don't know if you remember, everyone starts out as a legitimate heir to Alexander, but then there comes this moment where some people feel pressured into becoming a usurper and start attacking people. And that dance being hostile to each other before the actual gloves get thrown down really influences the overall tempo of the game. And so the early population pressures, the early territory grab feels different from the mid-game territory grabs, which feels different from the late-game races to the finish. And so that's one of the reasons why successors can be, you know, 4 hours easily, but I'm more than willing to spend that time because it just evolves and breathes in a marvelous way.
I have the same. I have evolving game state or a story arc. My examples were Barrage, where the map is filling up and you're deciding, you know, it changes from you trying to get in on infrastructure to adding water or to getting in on certain areas or traversing into scoring points as opposed to flowing water. Or like we said, Autobahn. The highways are filling up. You are realizing that your purple cards aren't useful anymore. So you're discarding those. You're getting different cards into your deck. You're sort of evolving as the game changes into, you know, different game states.
Yeah, I would definitely agree about Autobahn. I'm not sure about Barrage. I love Barrage, don't get me wrong. And I agree with you that there are different pressures at different times. But fundamentally, it's all about, you know, snagging water from your opponents, more or less. And so there's a sort of equivalency of tempo for me. Then again, I don't play Barrage very well, so maybe that's my problem. Quibbling at the margin at this point. Give us another random sentence, Walker. I want it to be random.
Time invested raises the stakes.
Oh, interesting. Okay, go on.
So the longer the game takes, the more of people's time get invested. That means the game might mean more. I don't just mean means you have to win or, you know, the urge to win is greater. It's just sort of everyone is joining into this sort of invested time sink.
That's a good point.
And you sort of try to make that fun for everyone.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons why there's a certain mindset that some people can get into. And I think everyone in the right circumstances can get into this mindset of feeling like the game isn't going properly. Like someone made a move and they think it's king making when it's not, or they get frustrated or what have you. And you really have to be careful. I agree with you that you can get that positive feedback of everyone getting super invested in the game. But then there can be that negative feedback around hour 5 or hour 6 or hour 7 where that turn happens and someone feels like their entire game has been wasted and or that player has been stewing for 3 hours about something that happened in turn 2. And I'm not criticizing. I have been that person. I just am always wary of circumstances in games that might contribute to that environment.
Well, that leads into this, the next sentence, which is time to pivot or recover.
Yeah, Walker, you said these sentences were going to be random, and so far they've all been on topic and relevant.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
All right.
You should be sorry.
So longer games give you, like, if a scoring opportunity, you know, closes or you realize that this isn't going to score you as many points as you thought, then you have time to recover. You have time to, like, switch which kinds of resources you're focusing on. When the game is longer, you have time to do these things.
I couldn't agree more. A couple of examples I wrote here are two games from the same publisher that I wish we could play more often, and that is Argent the Consortium and Millennium Blades. I came to love Millennium Blades when, for the first time, I really leaned into and explored this ability to pivot, because I had this sort of sunk cost fallacy. I kind of stepped with my starting deck. Millennium Blades is this fascinating gonzo game that kind of simulates the meta experience of being a competitive CCG player. But you start with a starting deck that synergizes with itself. And in my earlier playings, I'm like, I'm just going to make minor variations on this. But no, you have to be willing to be like, no, I'm just going to junk everything and start in this new direction to really make it sing. And the game gives you all the tools. This was a me problem, not a Millennium Blades problem. Argent the Consortium is the same way. You have to, you don't really know what the scoring conditions are in the middle of the game. And if you find out in the middle of the game that the scoring conditions are different from what you thought they were, well, you'd best pivot. But fortunately, you have the tools to do so, and there's the flexibility going on. So I agree absolutely. If the game is going to be that long, it can't be the case that a third of the way through you're locked out and there ain't nothing you can do about it. That's just garbage.
I feel as though they really need to have snappy turns. We've talked about this in Scythe. You do your action. Your turn is done. It goes on to the next player. Autobahn, you have your card. You're doing something very minimal. You're upgrading. You know, you're upgrading a road, building a gas station. Your actual turn is usually not that long, and you're on to the next person. If you start to get into these games that have super long, combo-tastic games, and they last 2 to 3 hours, you start to lose people.
I agree with you. I mean, all things being equal, you want all games to have good flow and good response. There is one game, though, that I still maintain is worth it. This is a bit of a controversial take, because a lot of people only want to play it digitally, and that's Through the Ages. Because Through the Ages in many contexts, has those very long combo-tastic turns. It's not a multiplayer solitaire game, but you do spend a lot of time interacting with the elements that are multiplayer solitaire. The reason why I think Through the Ages gets a bit of a pass for me is that they've done a very good job with the successive decks. And I think the balance is just about perfect where every stage matters. Now, the hardcore, super pro, ultra elite Through the Ages players, I get the impression some of them would disagree with me and argue that only stage 3 matters and that all the earlier stuff is just prelude. But that has not been my experience. Playing at a very, very low level, I think that Through the Ages does a good job of both escalating, that's a bit of that arc thing with going through the different stages of deck, and also keeps you invested throughout the entire game because you correctly infer that there could be an avenue for you going forward. What are your thoughts on Through the Ages? I don't think I've ever heard you talk about it.
I did play it a lot back on when in my traveling days because they had a very nice app. So sure. On flights and stuff, played a lot of
The digital version has kind of stolen the physical version's lunch.
But since then, I have not played it.
Okay, fair enough.
So you already talked about the next one when you were talking about Autobahn as well. It's clear scoring objectives. And as a side note, multiple goals. Right?
Yes.
So you sort of have that in Autobahn where you have your little sideboard where it says certain countries need certain goods. So there's all your side goals. And like you said, all the scoring opportunities are on one board. Everyone knows what they're trying to do. There's nothing hidden. There's no like worrying about it. It's like, well, I have no idea where I am in this game. When it takes, you know, several hours, that's just not the way to do it.
Yeah, especially since longer games tend, as a rule, to be somewhat more complicated, or at the very least, have the additional mental strain of processing relatively complicated board states. And I'm of the opinion that internalizing and simply understanding what other people need to do to win ought to occupy as little of that brain power as possible. The more time you're just trying to understand someone else's victory conditions, that tends to be a real drag on games, especially of the longer type. I think that there's also this idea of there's like a balance of intensity. I don't want a game to be unengaging at any point, but I do think that longer games can get too intense, as well as part of this ebb and flow thing. I think that it's very useful, again, pointing to Civilization, to have these moments where, okay, I'm rebuilding here. I'm at the height of my power. I'm juggling these different concerns, as opposed to it all being, I'm at the height of my power all the time. Because a game can be too intense. A classic example is I only played it once. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I don't think I ever want to play it again, was New Angeles. It was a 3-hour-long, negotiation-heavy game. And afterwards, everyone just felt drained. They were just spent. Because 3 hours of constant negotiation is a lot, even for me. That's why I would compare it unfavorably to something like the more intense games of The Resistance. I've had some knockdown, drag-out, 90 to 2 hour minute long games of The Resistance. But that's about the limit. I wouldn't want to go any further past that. But by the same token, you don't want it to be an entirely unengaged affair where there's never moments of intensity there, because there you could just get totally checked out. And of course, the moment somebody pulls out their phone, everyone's going to pull out their phone. That's a whole other issue.
I feel longer games lead into better replayability because there's many different avenues to play.
Like, yeah, the good ones,
Even as you're playing it, you're thinking, oh, next time I'm going to try to do it this way. You know, different goals to take, different orders.
Yeah, you certainly don't want a longer game that's too repetitive. That's for damn sure.
Well, this was a bit. It was supposed to be at the end. You don't need to figure out what to play next because it seems to be the new problem. We can't figure out what game to play. So if you play a long game, it takes the whole night.
Yeah.
So you won't have to figure out what game to play next because the night's already over.
Yeah, like I said, as much as I think your hobby life can be too scheduled, there is a joy in scheduling an event, scheduling an evening, scheduling an afternoon, what have you, where everyone knows this is what's going to happen. This is what's on the agenda, and you can just let it breathe. I do appreciate that.
I have here needs a solid core for gameplay. So in the case of Autobahn, it's those cards that I talked about. It's nice, easy. You play the cards. You get to upgrade your little hand of cards. Scythe, it's the action system. You have your row of actions. You can't take the same one twice. It's this basic core that drives the game forward that makes it easier to play.
Huh. I guess I'll agree that that's a virtue. I don't think it's a necessary component, though, because, again, I'll point to Civilization. One of the difficulties in classifying Civilization, any of the versions, is that, well, what kind of game it is? It's like, well, The trading is very important, but that's not really the core of the game in the same way that you've identified at the core of other games, because there's token manipulation, there's power acquisition, there's a sort of a conflict engine going on as well that's a different kind of token manipulation. It doesn't have like a central driving core. Everything you do is relatively simple and straightforward. I guess maybe that's the alternative. If you're not going to have a simple core to keep it together, you better make sure that no individual process is too complex. But I guess I would concede, I'll tell you what, I'll concede this. Civilization's lack of a central driving mechanism might be one of the ways in which it becomes a little bit more difficult to follow through the turn structure. I will tolerate no negative things being said about Civilization in this segment or any other segment, Walker.
Copy.
Okay.
Sometimes you need to feel as though what you do affects the board state for everyone, or just not everyone, but at least for some players, like some sort of interaction.
Yeah. Right?
Something that you're doing is affecting the game. You're not just playing, you're not just in your corner playing a solitaire game for 3 hours while everyone else is playing their own solitaire game for 3 hours.
Yeah, I agree. There's something particularly odious about multiplayer solitaire once it stretches past the 120-minute mark. I agree.
And here I think is something important. It's something that is fun.
Oh, should games be fun, Walker?
Well, I'm not sort of just not like the general fun. Like,
don't prevaricate. Answer the question. Should games be fun?
Games should be fun, Mark. Yeah. Well, I'm talking about an actual mechanism. Like, I'm talking about the delivering in Autobahn. Right, moving your truck around with the good, going to the different places, is interesting and fun for me.
Oh, little capstone terms. Little.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I think this definitely feeds into the sort of the ability to pivot, the fact that every stage matters, these moments of intensity, the arc. I think, yeah, that manifests itself in those neat little turns where it's not just okay. Well, I'm building another section of road. It's like, oh, I get to do this thing. Whee! You know, bonus activation.
Just so.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is this last one? It's just so good to know that everyone is having a good time, even though they're losing.
Why should I care about other people having a good time?
I think that
I should care about other people losing. That I should very much care about.
I just feel as though that's like in shorter games, we say it's okay because it's short. It ends quickly, and you know, losing is all right because you know the game is 10 to 15 minutes, half an hour. You know, you're losing, you're having a crappy time. Just bear with it; it'll be over soon.
Yeah.
Where longer games, they're usually designed that even if you're losing, you're still engaged and having a good time.
Mm. Fair enough. It's time for the bit now. Are you going
to
do the bit?
No, that was the bit. The bit about it lasts the whole night and you don't have to think of another game to play. That was, I just didn't understand.
It was a pretty small bit.
It was a small bit.
It was a small bit, okay.
Yeah, I don't know why it was in the middle there, that's all. Yeah.
I mean, I'm used to your bits being a little bit more elaborate.
I know.
Yeah.
That was all my sentences.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We hope to see you again soon, and take care of yourselves, take care of your hobby, and as always, please do thank your rules explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.